What's Underneath is a CastBox original produced in partnership with Studio 71.
CastBox is the fastest growing, highest rated podcast app on both iOS and Android, where you can find all of your favorite podcasts.
You can listen to What's Underneath wherever you get your podcasts, but we hope you'll give CastBox a shot and see for yourself.
Hello and welcome to What's Underneath,
the podcast that will inspire radical self-acceptance through empowering you to embrace what's unrepeatable in you.
I'm Lily Mandelbaum, and sitting next to me is my mom, Elisa Goodkind.
And we are Style Like You. In our new podcast, we are going to expand the types of intimate, unfiltered conversations we've been having in our viral video series, The What's Underneath Project.
Each week, we will interview diverse nonconformists about their relationship to style, self-image, and identity.
Being radically honest without shame and holding that honesty with compassion is self-acceptance.
Okay, so mom, who are we here with today?
So we're here with artist Sylvia Mayer, and she's someone that we have wanted to interview and feature for a long time because of how incredibly beautiful she is inside and out in terms of her style and her whole amazing being, and then her art, which just completely blows me away. Being an art history person and myself, I studied it in college and I loved Baroque art tremendously. And the minute I saw her art, which has a very Baroque feeling to it, but very contemporary and about very contemporary issues related to cultural identity and tolerance and all the other things that I really love, I was blown away.
And if any of you are interested in we're sitting in her home in Brooklyn, where she also has an art studio where she makes her work, and we're going to be photographing it later after we record so that we can share some of the beautiful artwork that she makes and also like a little tidbits of her home and her style on our Instagram account. So if you go to Style Like You's Instagram, you can see Sylvia and everything she is. Mm-hmm. Okay, so how are you, Sylvia?
Well, I'm really happy to be here, and I'm really grateful that I get this opportunity to talk with you, your mom and daughter team.
What are you feeling most excited about right now in your life in general?
My life?
Yeah, like what's getting you out of bed?
Wow. Well, I'm feeling super excited and scared because my son is going off to college. So that's bringing up a lot of emotions for me right now. You know, I'm trying not to put on my own anxiety or fear onto him, and just letting him fly and being happy that he's at that level that he can go and fly by himself. So I'm really wrestling with how much do I hold on and how much do I let go right now. So it's kind of bittersweet, you know, just trying to encourage him to do things, but inside I'm, you know, a little mushy.
Tight, yeah.
Like, what are some examples of that?
You know, as far as his decision of which school he wants to go to, I'm just trying to be an ear and listen and not put in my own two cents about, well, this school is closer, so you'll be closer to me, or it seems, you know, like a prettier environment, and things that a mom looks at, you know, and this is a shorter bus ride home, you know, and I'm going through his pictures when he was little and just can't believe how fast everything is gone. And I'm really excited to see what kind of person he becomes, you know.
Is he do you have two kids
Yeah, I have two boys. I have 15 and 17 years old.
It's a really having been through it myself twice, your kids leaving for college or leaving home is it's so huge. It's so huge in terms of your own identity.
Right. Right. You know, it's like I've had him here all these years, and they're very good kids, so they don't really go out. They're kind of sheltered, and I know where they are at all times, and to know that I won't know what they're doing or where they are, and just things you take for granted that I'm actually appreciating, like even doing the laundry or the dishes or little things that used to annoy me. Now I'm like, oh, well, you know, he's not going to be here for me to bitch about this right now. So I appreciate it.
And like, how is that making you feel? Like, what about like the whole, because the whole identity issue of like motherhood versus like, who are you? And it sort of hits at this time because you're, you know, suddenly you've been nothing but a mother for like 17 years or whatever it is. And all of a sudden it's like,
who am I?
When the second one goes, it's really that, but it's really like, who am I?
I have been maintaining my identity with my work. Mm-hmm. But I feel my as far as like your currency of how much you love somebody, that is really like the meaningful part of your life, and that is everything. So I feel that that is more important than anything, mm-hmm. you know, and that was like, that's the hardest job you ever have, right? Mm-hmm. That's the biggest emotional challenge and gift to be able to mother somebody. Mm-hmm. And all my paintings, nothing has been like the best creation, like a child. Mm-hmm. You know, that is the ultimate creation. And as a painter, we're all about creating. And when you see that this child, you're like, wow, why even bother? You know, God has done it such a great job, the creator. And you know, so in perspective to that, as far as my identity, I've always painted, and I made sure that I kept painting throughout my kid's childhood because it's just something that I'm compelled to do.
Is his leaving home and the prospect of his leaving home changing your perspective on your work?
Well, that's the thing. You know, people are like, oh my gosh, now you're going to have so much time to paint, and they're going to be gone and in school, and now your time is your own. And I think I'm a little scared of it, mm-hmm. to have all that time. And what if I produce shit? Mm-hmm. What if it's not the best work that I've done? You know, there's always that doubt, and there's always been an immediacy with my work. Having had kids and trying to maintain my identity as a painter, I would get in every minute I could to paint in the studio. And it was interesting because it changes how you approach your work. There was like, I have to give 100% focus because I have a limited amount of time. So I'm going in there with what matters and only that. I'm not doodling. I'm not painting anything that's not significant to the message that I want to convey with this painting. So in a way, there was a certain clarity that having my kids and mm-hmm. having to balance everything gave me. Like when I went in, it's no nonsense. I'm going in. Boom, get it done. So that's actually a gift of having to balance family life and being a creative person, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah, it's really grounding, actually. I talk to Lily about this a lot, where now that my kids are so independent from me, and I don't have anything to take care of like that on a day-to-day basis, even my animals are not babies, and I'm sort of craving to have another baby animal because it for me, somehow in my personality, and maybe it has to do with being an artistic person or not, I'm not really sure, but it's where my head's at. It grounds me. Mm. Otherwise I'm like, just, there's like no grounding. So I feel, this real lack of balance, like, 'cause I don't have this kind of internalized ability to ground myself. So
I know exactly what you mean as far as the act of serving someone else is quite selfish, I've found. I benefit a lot from it, mm-hmm. you know? And you aren't sacrificing anything. You're getting something.
You get something from giving so much.
You do.
And then without that
purpose,
giving,
a sense of like, okay, I'm being helpful to another human being. I have a purpose in this world, in this, you know, in this puzzle, And it does ground you. I know exactly what you mean. And actually, when my mom was ill and I was taking care of her, I felt that gift because it helped me, like, oh my God, there's nothing better than feeling like you're taking care of somebody, that you're, you know, you just, it's tremendous. It's a tremendous thing. And everybody would say, oh my goodness, you know, that must be so tiring and draining and a burden. And it's the opposite. Mm-hmm. And then
it's when, more fulfilling than anything you could be doing.
It's more fulfilling than anything. And then when she passed, I felt that lack too, and that lesson learned of giving was so selfish, and I needed it. I wanted to do it again. And that kind of springboarded me to my project with the mothers that I painted, because after she passed and I had this purpose of helping my mother and it was gone, then I found these other moms and I wanted to help them. I kind of wanted to continue that.
When was that? When did your mom pass?
She passed 7 years ago. Mm-hmm. It was a long road. It was a very long road. But
can you talk about it?
I can. It's just so... there are things you just never understand. And you just never know. And you just... you think you can love somebody better, you know?
What do you mean by that?
If I love you enough, I can fight this disease. Mm-hmm. You know, I can make it go away. Because you feel somehow empowered when you're loving somebody so intently. Because you do have all this charge and you have this strength. And you want to love somebody well, you know? You want to take it away from them and you can't. Mm.
So were you guys, were super close.
Mm-hmm.
You had a healthy, good relationship.
Yeah. Yeah, my mom and I, we were like friends, you know. Mm. She did everything they told you not to do. Don't be friends with your kids. Be the disciplinarian. Be the one that they look up to. Be. And she didn't do any of that. She was just... like my best friend. Mm. So. The loss was devastating. Yeah.
How many years was she sick?
She was, you know, from the time she was diagnosed, she had 10 years. From, it's a very rare brain disorder called PSP, supranuclear palsy. People call it PSP for short. It's the same thing that Dudley Moore had. And it was crazy because it happened at the same time that I moved away.
From her?
Yes.
From where to where?
So for me, it's hard to, I can't even express, because I thought everybody had that kind of relationship with their mother. Mm. And people don't. And we were like, symbiotic, like one person, like one heart. And when I told my mom, I'm moving away, mom, and she's like, oh really, where are you going? I'm like, next door, you know. It's just like I wanted to be with her all the time because she was just cool. And we were best friends. I could tell her anything and everything that people don't share with their parents. Mm-hmm. But my mother was never judgmental, so this, she was just on my side always. And
so you moved next door.
So I moved next door to the apartment next door.
Was it this place? No.
No, in Manhattan. We grew up on 69th Street and 2nd Avenue. Mm-hmm. And
I'm moving away next door.
Yeah. That's so great. And then, you know, she was a little eccentric, and her lifestyle was not, you know, politically correct, but she really
what do you mean by that?
Loved me. She just was... she was kind of gangster and delicate and very stubborn, and she did things her way, and she was unconventional. You know, she was a musician, and she came to New York from Argentina when she was 19, and in that culture, women don't leave your house, let alone leave Argentina to go to New York and, you know, pursue a career in the arts when she came from a family of medicine. All my uncles were doctors. And so she was a little bit of the black sheep. And, you know, so she was a little unconventional.
Which makes her awesome.
Yeah, truly awesome. Very, very cool.
When you're in your paintings, you paint musicians. Is that related to her, that your fascination with musicians?
You know, my mother was a classical pianist and my dad was a musician, R&B. And I've always loved music and musicians, and it's part of my fabric. So I think also trying to reconcile my relationship with my father, I paint a lot of musicians, trying to see them in a different light. And music has always been a part of my growing. And even my mom, when she had PSP and it was really bad, I would bring her up in her wheelchair and her stomach peg and her trach, and she couldn't even walk. But I'd put her in front of the piano and she could read Chopin and read a new piece of music and play it. It would be slow, but she would play it. And I remember when she would play and there was a rest in the music, that she would just take the rest. And then I thought to myself at the time, like, my mother, every time I heard music after, my mother is in the rest between beats, you know, because it's that veil between this life and the next. And I think it's like in music, with your music and then the rest part, and how the rest is as essential to the music.
Mm-hmm. It's the same with breathing.
It's the same.
You know, when you have like that, when you're supposed to be breathing correctly, there's like, or when you're doing yogic breathing, there's like a pause. Mm-hmm. And that pause is supposed to be the part that connects you to everything, you know, like it's the part between everything.
Yes.
Between ego and thoughts. And it's the part it's the same thing.
It's the same thing. So when she would play and she would take the rest, it was just so dramatic to me.
And what about your dad and how you're trying to work that out in your artwork?
Well, you know, I think sometimes you get one bad egg, right? Which happened to be my father was just a very frustrated and talented person who should never have had kids.
Why is that?
Because he was very self-absorbed and he had a very bad temper. He was very, very... He was always raging. He was always angry.
Were they together?
They were together, and such opposites as far as personality. And he was just a real abusive person where, like, my whole childhood, I remember just being terrified. I think that made me a better painter because I read people, you know, and I was always, as a child of an abusive relationship, you're always reading like, okay, you know, when is this the cue that he's going to go off the end? Or is this the moment that, you know, and I always had this desire to disappear because I thought if he doesn't see me, then, you know, I'm safe. I won't get hit. I won't get abused, you know.
And you were so you feel that gave you an ability to, like, so you observed, because being you mainly do portraits.
Yeah.
And do you feel that contributed to, is what you're saying, that you were able to, like, you're fascinated with people's faces and expressions and
body movement. I think that, you know, I've been thinking about it now, and as far as using your trauma to make something beautiful. Like, okay, so you have this shitty environment. And I remember as a kid being aware that this is not me, this is them. And I've just kind of landed into a really fucked up situation. I don't know why I thought that way as a child, but even as a child, I had this presence of mind to look outside of the situation and not put it on myself as if I was the cause. And it was a gift. I don't know. I was just born that way. But I always remember looking and saying, no, this is not my soul, my spirit. This is not me. Even as a kid, I was like, this is a screwed up situation. And when he, you know, my mother kicked him out and he left the house and I got older, I really took a lot of time to heal myself, to be my own mother as far as nurturing myself. I was very conscious always. And as far as reading situations, I was always very good at reading body language to know how to survive in a, you know, an intense situation.
How did your mom deal with it when he was still there?
He would never do anything like that in front of her. So when she was there, I had my protector. And I don't know if it was maybe because you see somebody so gentle, you feel ashamed to be violent. I don't know what her power was, but she had this inner strength, a very peaceful person. Then when I told my mother, she kicked him out, and that was it.
You told her that he would be abusive to you?
Yes. I said he was very, like, physically violent. Yeah.
So what would happen? He would, like, wait till no one was home?
Or, right.
And,
right.
And would you be have done something, quote-unquote, like, bad, or would it just be anything?
Anything. Anything. I came home, like, I had to walk to school and come back. If I was 3 minutes late, I get a beating. I mean, it was just like anything. It was really almost like waiting for me to mess up, waiting for me to do something. Because I never remember any time that it was warranted as a kid. And then I remember the first time I stood up to him and I told him what I thought. And I hid in the bathroom until my mother came home. And the next morning, you know, so then I crawled into bed with her. I slept with her that night. And that morning he came in and he had a belt and he was like, you know.
When she
I
left.
Got a beating, you know, that next morning with her sleeping next to me. So she had no idea what was going on. And that's when, you know, that was like the culmination of
like
it.
The
and
straw
that's
that
when
broke
he.
The camels.
Yeah, that's yeah. when she kicked him out. She was like, what's going on? And
so, you hadn't told her before?
No.
Why?
Well, she knew I was scared of him, but I don't know. I just,
but he,
I didn't
he
want to burden my
her?
Mother with it.
Right. I would guess. He yell in front of her and just wouldn't get physical? Or would he, was all of the rage like only towards you when she wasn't around?
All of the rage was towards me because he felt such frustration with his career. Mm. And I think
he blamed her for having
a child, right. You know, he blamed her for having a child, for getting pregnant, as if he didn't have anything to do with it.
How old were you when this like culminated like this?
So I just remember it from until like 11 years old. Mm. And I remember when my mother took me to Argentina with my grandmother, and my grandmother, when I was like 2, said, hey, I think he's a little, your child looks afraid of him. Mm. And so I guess she was in denial too, serious denial that,
right,
you know, it wasn't just like a disciplinarian thing, but like a really out of control temper.
What kind of musician was he?
He was a composer and a songwriter. And I still don't know if he's alive or dead. And I don't really want to know. And I don't care.
When was the last time you had any communication?
I think when I was 17, you know, he left. Well, my mother kicked him out at 11, when I was 11, and then we saw each other now and then. And I still didn't want to believe that somebody could be that dark.
Cruel. Yeah.
Do you know?
Mm-hmm.
So you wanted to give him the benefit of the doubt and see him once in a while.
Yeah. So I wasn't living
with
him.
Because he's like your father. It's hard to believe that your parent. It's very hard to comprehend, I think, as a child, parents doing anything to you that would be anything but loving. Like, it's hard to understand how that happens, even though it does happen. Mm-hmm. Even in some ways, it can be even worse. Emotional abuse in some ways can be even worse because it's not as clear.
oh my goodness, right, because you would wonder, is it me? Am I reading the situation correctly? Mm-hmm. You know, I can understand that.
So 17, you were saying.
So when I was, off and on, I would see him because I was dabbling with music again. And I thought, I guess the memory of the pain had kind of faded. And I wanted to see him on occasion. And then I remember the last time I saw him, I was 17. And he started to badmouth my mom. And that was it for me. And I just said, no, I'm done here. Mm. She's the one that's been taking care of me. She's always been kind to me. And you have always been a threat. So that was it for me. And then, of course, you know, my mother and I had conversations and she took responsibility because I was very angry with her for allowing this to happen too, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. And I gave her a really hard time because as I got older, I started to see, well, you know, your part in this. And we had a lot of very open conversations and she was always she apologized. She admitted that
she was accountable.
Really bad decisions and she was accountable for it. And it just allowed us to have that space to let it be, not pretend that it didn't happen, not pretend that she didn't see it, but just this is what happened and you're accountable as well. Mm-hmm. So we were able to work with that.
I think that's like such an amazing, so incredibly key and important to life. I think for everyone, and it's a lot of, you know, what we're trying, the message we're trying to give across with all the work that we do is just the, you know, that there is no lying, like, you know, mm-hmm. and there's no lying and having happiness in life or lying and having any real connection.
That's
to people.
It. You can't lie and have an intimate
and have
relationship.
A good relationship. No.
Especially a relationship between mother and daughter, or family, people you love.
I don't think you can lie and have a good intimate relationship with anybody.
Intimacy depends on intimacy, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Yeah. You've never heard that one, Mom?
No.
That's an oldie. Mm-hmm.
Like the abuse you endured like as a child, like do you feel like that has had, how have you seen that like fear or whatever impact that had on you like follow you into your adult life?
Well, it has followed me even though I made serious progress as far as I at you know, 16, I started meditating. I started with, you know, Louise Hayes, affirmations, trying to recalibrate my own brain. I mm-hmm. wanted to be in charge of my own mind. And it helped me, actually, because I've never, ever been attracted to a bad man.
Mm. You knew what not to do.
I knew what not to do. And these stereotypes that if you're abused, you're going to abuse somebody else, you're going to be in an abusive relationship, and although that may happen to some people, I decided anything that reminded me mm-hmm. of that situation, I was avoiding.
Yeah. I could honestly say that I think that I could see how that would be the case because I feel like I had a pretty like sheltered upbringing in that way. And like my dad was, and he has many flaws, but like he was always kind of like a neutral, nice seeming person. And sometimes I think that I was like not really naive, like when I started dating people, as far as like I didn't know what selfish. I don't know. I feel like there was a lot. I made a lot of bad decisions because I didn't know what not to look for at all.
You can't imagine because you have this role model mm-hmm. of a man that's a man, mm-hmm. a gentle, mm-hmm. gentle person. Now being a mom, raising boys, I use that and make sure that my kids, my boys, behave like men. That are gentle and kind mm-hmm. to women, you know. So it's always there, but I direct it in a different way.
You were explaining how it followed you into your adult life. You were saying that you did the affirmations and the meditations and
oh yeah, and I just realized at a very young age that I had this connection with myself. maybe because I'm an only child, but I felt like I'm with self, not by myself, but with self. Mm-hmm. And that I needed to take care of that self, of that child that was inside of me, you know. And I wanted to find beauty. And I saw everything that was so, like, I was like, there's got to be more than this. You know, I always felt like I came from another planet and I landed in this situation. I'm exploring Earth. And I was like, okay, this is not working for me. I see this side of humanity, but there's got to be something beautiful here too, you know. And so I became very like a seeker, looking for everything that was beautiful, that was, you know, different, that I could elevate my experience to, because I always felt life was very precious and I wanted to be in synchronicity with that. And I found it through painting, and that was also my salvation in a way.
Mm-hmm. If you're enjoying what you're hearing, please subscribe and give us a good rating so the powers that be can keep this podcast going. Sylvia and I were talking earlier about our own respective struggles with darkness and the fear of that darkness, but the knowing that we need to go into that darkness in order to be happy and liberate ourselves, and how that the pain is actually the gift. You know, because you were saying how, what would I be like had I not had this pain?
Right. That's what we were just talking about. Sometimes I wonder about, who am I really without this pain, without this history? Because, you know, they say young children, a lot of their environment is imprinted on them. And so I had these moments of thinking, well, who would I be without having had this trauma? Would I have not been so fearful in certain situations? Would I have not been whatever, all those little idiosyncrasies that are annoying, or
like what?
Or
can you talk
self-limiting?
Can you give examples?
Doubt,
of those?
You know,
like where's an area that you feel you doubt yourself? Because I look at you, I look at this amazing house that you're living in. You have a husband for mm-hmm. how long?
We've been married for 18 years,
and you have
together 22.
You have these two kids. You have this amazing career. So, can you talk a little bit about where you might feel limited by your pain, and where it's actually, what is that struggle?
Well, I wonder if I would have been more confident without the pain, if I would have been able to be more outgoing without the pain, if I would have been able to, like, not doubt myself, because that was really annoying. I think that it annoyed my mom too. Like, I would do something and then I'd be doubting it. And she's like, why do you doubt yourself all the time? Stop doubting yourself all the time. And there was always like, maybe like, oh, it's not quite good enough. Or
like your artwork, you mean? Or anything? Or how about your physical? Or like, where do you doubt yourself? Where do you feel not good enough?
As far as like making money, mm-hmm. why am I not like being more productive? Well, why am I not selling more work? Why am I not in the standard world? Why am I not able to maneuver in this world? I maneuver very well in my creative world. I feel like there are two worlds, you know. In my creative world, I'm totally like, I don't have the doubt. When I'm working, I don't have the doubt. I don't have any of that. And trying to kind of balance, like, you know, then when I look outside and I see the world and what we value as successful, that's where I feel like, shit, if I had the right kind of wiring and framework, I'd be more of a productive member of society, as far as like making money and having your savings right and being a grown up. You know, I feel very much like I'm not a grown up.
I have that same feeling. Exactly. I have that same feeling.
You know,
I wonder if I was thinking about it this morning. I think about it all the time. Like, yeah, like I just, even just the most perfunctory things are really hard for me to do, but it's not hard for me to create like a revolution for acceptance. you know, with like people, it doesn't even really sink in, but like with, you know, like a 14-year-old the other day, like I'm going, oh my God, like from South Africa, posting on Instagram saying, because of Style Like You, she has alopecia, she's bald, she's going to school today without her wig on. And, you know, we get lots of those messages, but like, it doesn't even really.
Well, that comes naturally to you is what you're saying.
Yeah, it just comes. So now I don't even think twice about it. I'm like, come on, let's more. Like, it's just, let's keep going. Right. Like, that comes so easily because it's creative.
That's huge.
It's creative, but I have no sense of what the monetary value of that is. Yeah. And so it's just.
Well, and as far as you saying, though, that you're not being a productive member of society, I think quite the opposite, because yes. Our society is like so backwards as far as what it values and like who it rewards with money.
Well, that's what I'm
like,
saying.
Right.
Yeah. Like, and this has been a struggle for me. That's why I painted the currency series. Nice segue. Yeah. But just saying, because I was really concerned with value and what we value at the time. And, you know, was the obsession with the banks falling apart and everything was about money and value. And I just wanted to investigate that idea of what do we value, and I guess try to bridge my own contradictions, my own struggles with the world and my inner life, you know. And for me, currency has always been about achieving your ultimate potential, you know, that is your highest level of currency, is that you come to this planet and then you fulfill your potential.
What would be a higher level of currency than that? My art teacher, who I love so much and who's an amazing artist herself, was telling me, and she was so embarrassed to say it as if I wasn't going to get it, but that her, you know, she's suddenly realizing how money and like how she has no money and she's in her 60s and she's been painting all of her life. And like, what about the future? And like, it's just occurred to her that she's never the same thing. She hasn't gotten paid.
You know, grown up stuff, that you have your money, you have your account, you're making, you know, you're making bank and that you're not. But also on the flip side of it, I also am sometimes, I don't even really care. I know what I do is with love and in the right place, and it's everything to me. And I don't have that kind of reaction, because I guess it's not my ego. When I go to work, I feel like I open up and I allow something to come through me.
And you realize because you would never trade being in your potential, which is what you're doing with your art. And you, that feeling, and that these other things are just measurements, that
outside validation.
Yeah, they're outside. They're measurements that society's created. They're not internal measurements. They're external measurements that that the society has created.
We're dealing with that same thing right now with our videos, where we've had this ride with the What's Underneath project, the series, you know, that we're most known for, where they started going viral and getting millions of views, and then you really have to work on not becoming attached to that, like,
right,
like, because this new series, which we love equally and think are just as amazing as every other one we've ever done, the of videos, isn't getting those, like, it's 4 years later and they're not getting that many views, and we have to work really hard on remembering like what our intention is and like why we're doing it and the way we feel when we're doing it and how much that matters more than, like, you know, the ADD internet culture and whether they've like decided to move on or the whatever, don't have the attention span anymore.
Because you'll never understand it, and it's not real, you know. And there's people, you know, if you're not true with your work, then why do it? And that's why I can't feel sad if I'm rejected from something, because I know that I'm true with it.
Totally.
The rejection is, it's almost liberating. Like
it is liberating. It's true. It's true. Because you never, I feel the same way. I'm not trying to do something for somebody else, so I can do whatever I want.
What are some of the, like, can you, what are the stand, like, what do you feel the most proud of? Is there something that stands out in terms of the messages that you've given through your work?
Drawing Down the Moon was very strong to me because I felt like with that painting, I had a very strong sense of fertility and movement, and I was able to say it. I also feel very proud of the bodega painting that I did of our local bodega owner, because I wanted to express the community of New York City, which is very multicultural. And I put all these images in the background of the painting of what we know from bodegas, like New Yorker and friend and Jews for peace. And I feel that that was very much an honoring of our local people and our local community, and in our political climate where it's so abrasive and racist, to show that us as New Yorkers, we're living in a bubble, and in our world we're all getting along here. I mean, my community, just within my small radius, here's this man running a bodega who has, you know, Caribbean clients, has all people from all walks of life. And I wanted to show that they're friends, that they're not the criminal element that is portrayed. Mm-hmm. There's somebody that sees my kids every day growing up every morning, and there's a certain trust. And that really disturbed me, how they criminalize Arab people. So I wanted to paint this Arab man who is the most peaceful man. He's praying all the time. He runs a bodega. He's part of the community.
What would you say is like a current insecurity that you're working on overcoming?
Not dimming my own light. Mm-hmm. That's something that I've been watching play out in my life, where I think it's also from my childhood of wanting to disappear. Mm-hmm. To just really being unapologetic and out there and allowing myself to just be and to be all of me. Mm-hmm. This role as woman, as mother, that somehow you have to be, you know, soft-spoken, you have to be pretty, you have to be the perfect mother, you have to be the Madonna, you have to be, you know, to be everything. And I'm not that way. And so sometimes I'm loud, sometimes I have a really raunchy sense of humor, and not toning it down anymore, not trying to
conform or in any
not way. Trying to to conform or even admit that I think things are so incredibly light and so vibrate on such a high frequency, and not trying to lower my vibration. So that's really an insecurity that I've been dealing with, where I feel sometimes like, okay, just take it down, you know, take it down, because I'm really like in my higher self most of the time. Mm-hmm.
And I really people, relate to that
and
a
most
lot.
People don't get it, so you feel...
You know what I mean?
I really relate to that a lot. Like Tia, who's our amazing producer of this podcast, and we couldn't do this podcast without her. When I was interviewing Lily and Lily was interviewing me to get this podcast going, one of the questions was, Lily, how do you feel when your mom is so like electric kind of with certain people? And I felt that way the minute I met you or I talked to you, or everyone that we interview. And the reason that I get that way is because I feel so dimmed, or like I have to apologize for myself so much in my life, that when I'm around my people that don't make me feel that way, that the conversation is just, it doesn't end, and it just gets deep right away, and it gets everywhere right away. And I don't feel I have to like cover up any of my any part of myself. It's like so intoxicating because I feel so not that way most of the time that it's like a drug.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that's the friends that I cultivate. We're kind of on in that area. And I find it very fulfilling because that's really where I want to be. Mm-hmm. And I'm working on, okay, so if a situation isn't really matching that, not to change myself, not to alter myself, not to try and bring it down. Mm.
Totally.
What about your style? How does your style play into that?
I want to be comfortable. I want to be like comfortable in my own skin. I wear fabrics that make me feel sensual and just feel good against my body. I want to be like flowy, you know, I just want to flow through life. So lately I've been wearing a lot of kimonos and things like that, that are just kind of flowy. And
what about your hair? Have you always had these long dreads?
No, they came like 8 years ago. So it's usually, that's to comfort mm-hmm. because I'm lazy.
So can you explain that?
I got tired of dealing with corkscrew curls, which I could only comb them in the shower and sleep a certain way. I'd have to braid it if I didn't, you know, at night. So the next morning I would look, you know, kind of pulled together. But even then my hair was natural and very much myself. But I think once, you know, I think my thyroid started to go a little down after having the two kids, and I started to feel like I was losing a lot of my hair in the shower. And it was very hard to tell anybody because when you have big curly hair, nobody can tell that you're like losing your hair when you still have a huge like afro. Mm-hmm. But I knew I was kind of losing a lot of hair after the pregnancy. And then I was like, you know what, I'm just going to lock it so I don't have to deal with it and keep my hair on my head. So I think that's kind of how it evolved now that mm-hmm. we're talking about it.
Mm-hmm. You certainly don't look like you've lost any hair.
That's what I mean.
Mm-hmm. You look like you have something to give away.
Yes.
Like to me.
And before I had even more hair. Yeah.
And what about...
So never, you've never like sort of felt any need to conform style-wise to or dim your light style-wise? You always felt comfortable expressing yourself naturally.
You know, being a mixed kid in a very homogenous world at the time, I felt like an outsider. I felt like the black sheep because everybody had straight hair. And in the 80s, everybody like worshipped this like Barbie doll blonde, mm-hmm. which I was never going to be. Mm-hmm. And my mom was white with straight hair. So I thought she was just so beautiful. And I wanted straight hair to look like her. I didn't really get the whole race issue because when I was a kid growing up in the city, I chose my friends based on who they were. One of my best friends was Filipino. And then I remember when I went to another school, a private school, and the first day of school, the black girls came up to me like, oh, you've got to be our friend now. I didn't understand. And I said to them, well, I'd love to be your friend. It's just, don't you want to get to know me first? I couldn't understand how that you could choose somebody to be your friend without knowing them just because they look like you. Mm-hmm. Now, I understand. Walking around in our skin color, in our complexion, there is a certain camaraderie that you have with people that look like you and that, you know, undergo the same struggles of being black in America. And I get it and I understand it now. Mm-hmm. I guess at the time I didn't really experience it because I was very young and I didn't, I felt like an outcast and I wanted to be friends with them, but I wanted it to be based on
who you were.
Yeah. Because what if, yeah, I'm black like you, but what if you don't like me? What if I, you know, what if we have nothing in common? What if, you know, let's just like slow down. Let's, you know, let's get to know each other first. And So that kind of alienated me in high school, not even intentionally. Mm-hmm. So I was always pretty much on my own, in my own, but not because I was stuck up or anything. I just had no other way of seeing people at that time. Mm-hmm. And then when I went to Argentina and I was in a very homogenous environment with I did feel, oh, okay, being the outcast, being, you know, black in an all white environment, and how difficult that was, as far as like being stared at all the time and feeling very uncomfortable with it, you know, when you're the only one. And then it was hard to be the outcast, and then being with my mother's family, who at this point, you know, my father was out of the picture, and then I felt like I represented this part of the couple that was hurting their daughter. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I took on mm-hmm. all of this shit that wasn't even me. Mm-hmm. You know, my grandmother adored me as a brown, adorable baby, but I felt this shame of being that part of the relationship, looking like that part of the relationship, not being ashamed of being black. If I had blue eyes and he had blue eyes, anything that would remind anybody of him through me made me feel very shameful. Mm-hmm.
And then also put what you were saying, it put you also in a position when you were in Argentina and with your mom's family of understanding what those girls, the girls that came up to you and yeah. wanted to just be your friend just based on
being brown,
on your race.
Right.
It made you understand what that.
Then I understood yeah. what they were doing. And then I was like, okay, I get it now. And then when I did go back, you know, I cultivated mm-hmm. those friendships mm-hmm. and I embraced those friendships, and I understood where it was coming from. And I was grateful to them, because then I became very concerned about my, you know, people of my race suffering and
right
wanting to express that in my paintings.
Oh,
and can you the talk men about that? That I paint, think, yeah. I thought, okay, I want to, again, it's always been about healing myself. And then I became so aware of race that I became aware of stereotypes. I became aware of how we're seen in the media as black men. And here I was having all these wonderful black friends and black men friends. And I was like, well, he doesn't act anything like my father. You know, because I had this, like, this is something that really stuck with me. And I wanted to create positive images of people that I knew. I didn't even have to create the positive images, just documenting who they are.
Mm-hmm. To heal yourself and to heal the culture.
Right, because I didn't want to walk around with this pain thinking that I'd have a... I don't know, it's very difficult to explain when you have had a situation of abuse and then you want to distance yourself from that abuser. You don't want to be seen as the abuser, no matter who they are. And I think that looking into myself, I saw that and I wanted to correct it.
What would you say is like a remaining source of shame in your life? Is there anything that you can think of?
I think I've released my shame. I feel very forgiving. I feel forgiving of myself. I feel forgiving of my father, even though I feel forgiving of my mother. I feel... I don't feel shame. I feel this is who I am and that I'm making the best of my situation. I always surrounded myself with people that were good for me. So I'm not feeling shame anymore, which
awesome.
Is pretty cool. Nice.
What What's the biggest risk you've ever taken?
My biggest was trusting. I think my biggest risk really was to trust, because I had a hard time trusting
people.
Yeah. I had a really difficult time letting people in, letting my husband in.
Trusting him was a big risk.
Oh my God. Trusting a man was a huge, huge risk for me.
Mm-hmm. How did you learn to do that? Like what happened?
Well, he was relentless, you know.
Pursuing you.
Yes, pursuing me. And I was just, I had a really hard time trusting his love. I guess maybe that's where the shame was. I had a really hard time, like, even now, I was like, I don't understand how he can be with me 18 years later. And I sometimes look at him like, is something wrong with you? You know, I do have a hard time believing that he could love me like that. Mm-hmm. So the trust is my biggest issue, but I've been working on it.
How do you work on it?
That's when I go back and I realize that, is it me or is it the trauma? Mm-hmm. You know, if the trauma didn't happen, would I be able to trust somebody's love? Probably so. So a man's love, right? Mm-hmm. And that helps me. And also really his actions. So when I just pull myself back and I look at it rationally, all of his actions have been those that show that he can be trusted, you know?
Like what?
Supporting. When my mom got sick, he took my mother to like every single one of her doctor's appointments. Mm-hmm. He was there when she died with me. So, pretty solid, pretty mm-hmm. solid person, not running away when you see that things are getting difficult, because it was a 10-year trip with my mom and having little kids at the same time, because I told you she got ill right as I was starting my new life, having these little babies to take care of, and then watching my mom start to get ill. And telling him, look, you know, my mother has to live with us because I can't function if I'm worried about her all the time. And to go through that is really hard. The stress, every time I'd hear an ambulance, I thought, are they coming to my house to get my mother? Hospital visits, is she going to fall? Is she breathing? Do I have to tend to her wound? You know, I mean, like real life stuff. Does she have pneumonia? Do I have to fight with doctors? Do I have to get her out of the hospital? Do I have to, you know, things that are not romantic, things that are life and death. When you deal with somebody and your situation is life and death and they're your partner and they're with you, you can trust them. Yeah.
That's beautiful.
And
that's really beautiful.
What are you most afraid of?
I can't say dying.
You're not afraid of dying?
No.
Why not?
Because I was with my mother when she died. And I saw it. And I feel like I kind of went with her there mm-hmm. and came back. And I know everything is going to be okay. I think that was her gift to me for taking care of her all those years was, I'm going to show you the ultimate thing of what you're afraid of. I'm going to show you it's okay.
How did she show you that?
She showed me because, you know, so it was 5 weeks in the hospital and I spent every night at the hospital. I'd sleep with her in the bed. In the ICU, in wow. the bed with her, and the doctors would just tend to her and work around me. And I, you know, I felt like I had this opportunity to, it's not my time to go. But as I told you, we were so close that she's like, I'm going to share dying with you. Mm-hmm. And when she died, you know, we took her off the machine and she was like, she had the moment of clarity. I mean, that's when she was clearer. She looked at me and she was very clear. And you know, you ever smell something, you're like, I know that smell. You're like, I know this smell. And you're trying to figure out, how do I know that? Where do I know that smell from? Right? And it was so strong. It's like, and I said to my husband, Andre, do you smell? He goes, yeah, I smell. What is that? And I was like, I don't know, but it's so familiar. And he went out of the room. And as I put my hand down over my face, I knew, oh, that's my grandmother. That's the smell. It's my grandmother, because I remember her smell. And as I had that moment of realizing I'm smelling my grandmother right now, my mother opened her eyes and she looked straight ahead and she smiled. Wow. She smiled and then she died.
Wow.
Yeah.
Ooh, like in a way, like she saw your grandmother?
She saw my grandmother. And so it was like,
wow.
I smelled my grandmother. My mother saw my grandmother. Wow. And then she went and wow. She went smiling. And that's how I knew that that was my wow. gift. That was the gift. That was the gift for all gift. Those years of loving and being so close to her. That was the gift.
That's so awesome.
Yeah.
And you.
So I didn't feel afraid anymore. I felt like I didn't feel any fear. So but it was very liberating. She let me in.
She let you in.
She let me in. She's like, just stay with me. I'm going to show you this. This is the last lesson. I'm going to show you this.
And she was vulnerable enough to let you in. Like, I just think so much in our world right now, there's so much fear around aging, fear around death, and that people that are in those positions aren't talking openly enough about it mm-hmm. with their children because mm-hmm. it would be helpful.
Oh my God, I think that's a very important conversation to have. You in part of the process. Yeah. And I remember her doctor told me, it's the first time that I've ever treated a patient's daughter. Really, because my mother was very holistic and she was fine letting things happen naturally, but she stayed alive for me. And she told the doc, just do what my daughter asked you to do, because she knew I couldn't handle it, you know, her leaving. Mm-hmm. So that fear was taken away. And now my fears, I think if I say I had a fear, maybe not having my kids feel proud of me, you know, maybe that's it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe mm-hmm. to feel like not loving them in the way that they needed to be loved, you know? To and leave maybe them failing with, that, right?
To leave them with that sense of self and happiness for their own lives. Mm-hmm. And you know that you can affect that.
Right, right. Like that's my greatest fear is that.
I relate to that.
Yeah.
I also think that that's another topic that isn't talked about enough, which is I think there's a lot of parents that just feel like they wash their hands. Okay, had them, here they are, they're off to college or whatever it is, done, stop, you know, don't have to look at myself. And I see mothering so opposite from that. I feel like you're never done because if you can't ask anything of them that you're not doing yourself.
Right. You can't. And you're the listening part, that these people you care so much about, have you been able to, I can say I love you, but if you don't feel the love, then I'm not doing it right. So how do I find the way to connect to you that I love you the way you need to be loved? So that's my thing is like, I hope that I can do that.
It's literally what I'm going through with my husband because we've been together for 33 or something, for 5 years at this point, but like married for 33 or something. And I know we're like relics.
That's great.
But it doesn't come without, of course, without enormous struggles and tensions and ups and downs and backs and forth and everything. And literally we were talking about, I mean, if I had to distill our relationship right now, it's exactly the same thing where he's learning. He just always had this idea. I just love you. That's all. But I'm like, but if I don't feel that you're, that you love me, what's the point?
Exactly. Exactly.
We were literally having this conversation last night. Like, I'm like, you just don't say, I love you. Just saying, I love you does not mean that the people around you
feel
that you, that's so unaccountable and selfish and like, and just unaccountable and fearful. It's not taking responsibility.
It's not taking responsibility
For your position
right. in
these people's
in their lives.
Right.
And that is what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
That's why I had a great relationship with my mother, because she knew how to make me feel loved, right? There was a connection. And if I can't break the code of my child, what they need, how they need, then, you know, I'm not doing it.
You're not taking it's not your end of the bargain. You're not living, because then you can't. It's all about ego. I mean, it's all about being able to admit you're wrong, to be able to be just completely accountable for your behavior, to be vulnerable, to be willing to learn, to not have to be right.
Right. Yeah.
It's all these things that keep you in, that keep this,
and
keep this in between you and making that pure connection.
And it's
with somebody.
A movement. It's always movement between two people, and it's listening to them and how why, it's not even why anymore. It's not even asking why. It's just figuring it out, you know?
The person feels it or they don't.
Right. And well, so if you don't feel
it. I like the quote. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, go ahead.
There's this, in Lady Bird, did you guys see Lady Bird, the movie? They say at the end of it, like someone says in it, love is what you pay attention to. Like what you choose to put your attention towards is love. Like it's not just saying something.
It's an active thing. Yeah. It's a behavior, you know, it's active.
Mm-hmm. Ongoing all the time, forever changing. What does the other person need?
Mm-hmm.
It's not this frozen,
I love you statement. It's not a statement. And everybody like, oh, I love you. And you get into this habitual thing of you kiss each other. Hello. Oh, I love you. Mm-hmm. It's like, what does it mean? I mean, you know, what does that mean? It's just like this conditioning, this habit, but you know, you want more, you want to feel deeper, you want to, it's one life,
you want to
have an experience, right? You're sharing your lives with somebody else, which is huge, because you have, you know,
which is such a vulnerable thing,
which is huge.
It's
you
the
made
ultimate
this decision to share your lives with this person, and then not even with children, you made a decision to have them, right? Or not.
Yeah. I recently, someone that we interviewed for What's Underneath, and I think it's the title of her video because I loved it so much, but she said she had a very rough relationship with her family and her parents. And she said parents should thank their children.
Mm.
And I really agree with that.
So what does self-acceptance mean to you? What do you think? How would you define it?
Self-acceptance is accepting all your fuck-ups and your flaws and your inability to love more. Because usually that's where I get into the trouble, is like I feel like I haven't loved enough. I haven't been able to be vulnerable enough with the people that I care about. And even when you're guttural, or when you're mad or angry or confused, to just accept it And it's okay. You know, you don't have to be perfect. You don't have to be sweet all the time. You can be salty. You can get angry. It doesn't make you a bad person. Mm-hmm. You know, I've often felt like if I'm mad, then I'm a bad person. If I'm, you know, bitching about something, I'm a bad person. You know, I'm not grateful. And just sometimes things are shitty. You know, there's a shitty situation and you can say it. And it doesn't mean that you're like, because sometimes I feel like the opposite, always trying to be the optimist. And some things are just not, sometimes there's not a good situation. Mm-hmm. And to allow yourself without judgment to just be bitchy or be cranky and not judge yourself. Right?
Mm-hmm. It's part of being human.
Mm-hmm. And if you could give any piece of advice to your 11-year-old self, the self that was, you know, dealing with what you were dealing with, wanting to...
Hiding in the bathroom.
Hiding in the... If you could say anything to her, what would you say?
That's going to be okay. And that it's not you. It's really not you. And to be brave, to be brave. You know, and to be brave because that was a very difficult situation, standing up to an authority figure, even though you're in the right, and be punished. Mm-hmm. So be brave. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. That was absolutely amazing. Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much.
That was such a treat. Healing. That was such an unbelievable gift to the world, to us, and now to the world. Really such a gift you are.
Thank you.
That was big. This is big of you, and kind and generous, and you gave so much to us just now that I'm vibrating right now.
We hope you were inspired by this episode.
Until next week, that's it from me, Elisa.
And me, Lily.
If you agree that facades separate us and being radically honest brings us together, help spread the movement for radical self-acceptance by sharing this episode and subscribing to our podcast.
You can also watch our videos by subscribing to our YouTube channel and following us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook using the handle @StyleIQ.
That's the letter U instead of the word you.
And check out our book, True Style is What's Underneath, The Self-Acceptance Revolution, on Amazon or at a local bookstore near you.
We can't skip ahead to a happy ending or live inside a Photoshopped image or an Instagram filter. There's no finding oneself when glossing over the truth.